We live in unsettled times. More and more knowledge is available to us, but the amount of time for us to pay attention to it remains the same. What kind of knowledge will be needed, and in what ways are we going to be acquiring it? Those are a couple of the big questions that all educational institutions are contending with. So let's get into this. Here's George Siemens, professor at the Center for Distance Education and a researcher and strategist with the Technology Enhanced Knowledge Research Institute. That's TECRI at Athabasca University in Alberta. And it's great to have you here again, George.
It's a pleasure to be here, Steve.
Well, let's talk about this because the education system, of course, is in the midst of historic revolutionary changes. Do you or any of your friends know where this revolution is taking us?
I think no one really does. There's a lot of people who have desires and goals for what the system should look like, but the amount of components in the education system that are up in the air right now makes it almost impossible to predict. It's everything from policy issues on the government end, it's the growth of commercial activity in the education space, to just economic pressures on end users, the students of the system. So it's almost impossible to predict where we're going as a system.
Wherever we are going, though, I have heard you say that we have to put the student as an individual at the center of everything because that's the holy grail. What do you mean by that?
Well, when you consider what we do in education, most of the education system is to improve the quality of society through improving the individual members of society. So higher quality of education, a better ability to gain employment that they're interested in, and just the ability to have more critical, thoughtful views of the world around them. There are research components to the education system as well that are quite significant, but for the teaching and learning experience, for the people who are actually paying tuition dollars, they have to be at the center of the experience. And in the past, we needed the university to do a lot of the knowledge mediating for us. Mm-hmm. Suddenly the web comes along, then we have Web 2.0, then we have social media, then we've got the open education movement, then we've got massive open online courses, and next thing you know, students can organize without an organization. They can, in a journalist sense, go direct to source. They don't need the university to play that mediating role. So if the university wants to stay relevant in the lives of students, they really have to start looking at what do students want and need, what kinds of tools and technologies do they want, how are they interacting with information outside of the class setting, and that whole range of factors that influence what students come, both in terms of expectations and in terms of needs.
So once upon a time, it was kind of a factory setting, one size fits all. Yeah. We're now into a much more personalized sense of how to learn. How's that going?
Well, it depends who you talk to, mm-hmm. you know, because certain things, one example, there's a company called Newton, and they, in an afternoon of working with their system, they say they collect in excess of 150,000 data points on you. So they literally know when you log in, let's say the next day at 8:17 in the morning, after they have a profile of you, they know that you're very bad at this kind of math first thing in the morning until you had a cup of coffee. But they also know that after you've been with their system for 30 minutes, there's an increase in your productivity. They speed up the pace at which you provide or you get content and so on. So it's very, on the one hand, interesting because it takes into account who are you as a learner, right? What kinds of skills and knowledge do you have that you've developed versus somebody else in the class that isn't getting the same kind of feedback? The difficulty, though, is that only works if there's a right answer. So certain areas like math or physics or chemistry, that kind of personalization works well. But if you want someone to think critically about philosophy or even think creatively about challenges that need to be solved in society, all of a sudden personalized learning, algorithmically driven, doesn't work as well anymore. And then we need to start moving back toward the teacher and the student relationship in order to encourage that kind of creativity.
Why doesn't it work in the latter example you gave?
Well, at this point at least, the algorithmic models that we have aren't great at generating creativity. And they are able to duplicate those parts of the education system where there's a known answer. Because what, and essentially, I'll go through this very quickly, but so here's the process. You take a knowledge domain and you map out all of the concepts and you map how all of those concepts are related. And then the student begins to interact with the system and they build a profile of you and they compare your knowledge profile with the knowledge in a discipline. Let's say it's Physics 101. And then they find out where you have gaps. And then it's basically, you know, map, compare. And then that's how they feed you the personal content to get your math course or your physics course credit. When you start looking at something like political issues, where there's human social factors at play, there's opinions and beliefs and viewpoints, and there's worldviews and epistemological orientations, that's almost impossible to map, at this stage at least.
Hmm. Okay. But is the education of the future going to be designed around the idea that if a student is passionate for knowledge and is allowed to pursue that passion, they will be a more motivated, more engaged student.
I think that's the goal. I mean, it really is. You mentioned earlier this notion of sort of industrial models of education. And even now at a small level, let's say you have a class where you've got one faculty member or one teacher and 30 students, or in some university lecture halls, you know, 300 or more. Mm. That model, I think, has a short lifespan. And it will eventually end up being, you know, one-on-one or personal knowledge profile or intelligent tutors that are able to fill some of the gaps for students. The big problem is going to come in is if we overplay the role of technology in that. So recognizing there's a lot that technology can do to help provide personal knowledge or personal information that they need, but there's still that development of knowledge that can come primarily through discourse and interaction with peers. And we're not good at that latter part yet through algorithmic systems.
You guys in education are great at the jargon. There are new words I've never heard before, so let's do some of that here. Okay. The idea of constructivism when it comes to the acquisition of knowledge, what does that mean?
Well, very broadly, and this gets back to, once you start talking learning theory, and typically this is where you just lost half your audience, just so you know.
So bring them back, George. Get them back. We need them back.
Come back. when you start talking about learning theories, you're looking at sort of the epistemological views. Like, how do you view knowledge? You know, is knowledge something that can be defined by an expert and then just duplicated by an individual that accesses that knowledge later? And so essentially, if you're the prof, you're familiar with the content area. So the way I learn is essentially by just duplicating what you've done. And this has been historically, behaviorism was for the longest time the educational theory. It emphasized we don't care what goes on in the human mind. We just want to see the end result of their behaviors. Then getting into the 50s, 60s, a lot of it influenced by military training systems, we ended up with something called cognitivism. And that's where we're really looking at a computer model. You know, we put things into the brain, it gets processed, stored, and we can retrieve it later on. But during that cycle, and this does go back earlier with Vygotsky and other theorists, but we ended up with something in the 70s and 80s, you know, I guess even 60s with Piaget, but called constructivism. And constructivism says that you generate knowledge through active engagement with something. You can't just sit there and read, write, and try and understand something. You have to mess with it, play with it. And if you and I take the same course, we're going to have two different versions of knowledge at the conclusion of that course.
Now, is that back now?
That's constructivism. I think in many ways that has had a significant impact in many sectors of education. Mm-hmm. There are...
But I guess what I mean is, did it go out of fad and now, or did it go out of style and now it's come back as an organizing principle?
I think it is. I really think it is a broad organizing principle, but not in all fields. And that's one of the big problems with education sometimes is we talk about it like it's a unified field. But it's a messy, chaotic, stratified, distinct field where talking to a physicist will give you a very different... often a different epistemological view than if you're talking to someone in gender studies.
Okay. New one. Fragmentation is a new reality. Our learning models need to embrace it. So say you. What does that mean?
Well, it means... So when in the past, if you go to university, you take a course. And that course has been nicely prepackaged. You'll buy one textbook. You'll read that textbook. You'll do the questions at the end, so to speak. And you get a coherent view of that discipline or that knowledge type. Now with the web, in the last 10, 15 years, heavily in the last 5 years, all of a sudden those knowledge pieces don't cohere the way they used to. Just like an album has been broken down into individual songs, in the same sense, a course has broken down from a textbook into smaller knowledge elements. So even if I'm taking a course, and again, let's go back to you being my prof. So I'm taking a course with you, and you may have a textbook that you want me to read. But while I'm reading that, I'm going to join a Google group to talk with colleagues. I might follow somebody that you're quoting or teaching me about in a class. I might follow them on Twitter. These days, I might take an open online course with a group like Coursera or edX.
I definitely lost my monopoly, haven't I?
That's exactly it. So probably one way to look at it is in the past, education was more like a wheel, you know, with the instructor as the center, the spoke, you know, sort of spoke and hub model. And today, the instructor is still critical. The course textbooks that you select are still important, but they're no longer the central part. They're now a node in an overall network with numerous other knowledge nodes competing for what you do.
Education today is about learners understanding relationships, not simply memorizing facts. Again, I'm quoting you. What do you mean by that?
Well, I meant that in a lot of cases, if you go to a university, certainly at a graduate level, you're going to get information put your way, and in a lot of cases, our exams and our studying will then test and evaluate that. There was a very interesting study that was done, well, study's maybe not the right word, documentary. It's called The Private Universe, and this is about 20 years old now. They took a group of students graduating at Harvard, this is on graduation day, they've got their bachelor's, smartest people, one of the best systems in the world, and they asked them, why do we have seasons? And the vast majority of them were not able to answer that question. They had all kinds of conceptual errors in how they understood why we have seasons. So what happened is you push this group of people through a system, and they were able to answer all the questions that you gave them on the test so they could repeat facts back to you, but they didn't understand how those knowledge elements related or formed what I would call it sort of a knowledge network.
What's the answer to that, incidentally?
It's the tilt of the Earth's axis. So most of the students felt it was how close the Earth was to the sun, but 23.5 degrees is the magic number.
See, I would have had a completely different answer. I would have said, how are you going to know when baseball season starts if you don't have spring? How are you going to know when hockey season starts if you don't have fall?
Yeah. See, now that would be a constructivist speaking.
And I just flunked. Okay, having said all of this, here's where the old fogey in me comes out, okay? Reading the National Post a while ago, there was a story that revealed, I think it was Memorial University in Newfoundland and Labrador, and they were asking students, you're at this institution of higher learning, and incidentally, folks, what is the large body of water that surrounds this island? And a lot of them couldn't tell you that it was the Atlantic Ocean. So we live in a very interconnected world now. We live in a world of personalized education. We live in a world where the professor is no longer the hub of the spoke. And yet, there are basic bits of information that students seem blissfully ignorant of. That can't be good, is it?
No. In many ways, it's not. Now, it depends what kind of information is it. So is it information such as naming things? I mean, I would typically look at that as low-level knowledge. But is it information about historical facts? Is it information about how social systems are impacted? Let's say right now, austerity, the austerity discussion that's going on economically. And for a period, it was the way to go. We've got to balance budgets. We have to cut. And then all of a sudden now, with some of that research being debunked recently, or at least being criticized, and the European system, which has been heavily embracing austerity, all of a sudden the question becomes, why weren't we looking at history? Why weren't we looking at other illustrations of when this has happened? So I think the reason you want to have base knowledge, and certainly historical knowledge, is a higher level of understanding, and this is the way experts think as a rule, is through patterns. And there's been research that looks at a novice will think sequentially, you know, step one, step two, step three. Mm-hmm. An expert can look at a pattern and recognize something that others can't because of the breadth of her experience. So from that end, it is important that people do have a grasp of history. They have a grasp of what I would look at as sort of the big ideas of a democratic society.
But what about people, places, and things? Is that still is that still important?
Well, this is where this will be controversial, but my view typically is if I can find it on Google, I don't necessarily need to know it in my head when it comes to naming things. It's not, I mean, if my doctor has to Google my symptoms, then I'm a little more concerned, but on one level, I'd rather that she did Google it rather than guess and get it wrong. But a lot of that kind of information, if it's readily accessible, I think as we move forward, both with our education system and as society, we'll start to recognize that the technology aids that we have and use are actually part of our overall cognitive process, which means that we treat Google as part of our brains. In the past, I remember doing my own master's and doctoral work as well. The way I stacked and organized my papers was I was going to read this, study that, do this and that. So even then, I was extending my intelligence through the physical artifacts around me. It helped me think. Now, with digital devices, mobile devices, I think it's just augmenting human cognition to the degree that it's actually a part of our thinking.
Okay, I hear you, but, and look, this is your business, not my business, but it feels to me like if you're going to be an engaged Canadian citizen at the dawn of the 21st century, you've got to know we're a parliamentary democracy, you've got to know that our head of state's the Queen, you've got to know that the Prime Minister is in charge of the government. Don't you need to know all that stuff?
I think it would be good that you do know that. I would also think it would be important that in the event that you don't know it, that you know how to quickly access that. So I do agree with you that is foundational, but if some of those elements are lacking, it's also about what's more important, the ability to name things, such as the particular, parliamentary procedures or the ability to talk meaningfully about democracy. It's great if you have those basic terminologies, but you can still go a long way talking about human rights and ethics and fairness in a democratic system. You don't have to name all of the Canadian prime ministers sequentially in order to say, the government's doing something that's wrong and I don't like it. And that part, creating engaged citizens that are willing to learn from one another. And perhaps another way to look at it is to think in a collective or a connective model becomes quite important.
I'll meet you halfway on this. You got to know who the prime minister is today, though, don't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. I think we can meet in the middle on that one then. How about this? What percentage of university teachers, university professors, to your knowledge, are positively engaged on the ideas that you're all about?
That would be very difficult to comment on. So, quick illustrations. I was at the Ryerson University conference this morning. I delivered a talk, and it's their annual faculty development session. So it's a full day. 550 faculty are involved, and some of the topics they're exploring, I would say, are very aligned. And what's important about this, I mean, they're looking at how to use different tools in the classroom, using clickers, because the goal there is generating student engagement. How do you get students involved in critical, valuable discourse around the knowledge topics that they're engaging in so that they understand it, not so they can just label and name things? And so the difference I would look at it is a lot of education today is about naming nodes, right? This is what this is here, that is what that is over there. My interest is in abstracting that up at a certain level so we can begin to see the pattern that's there. What happens if this node over here changes, right? What happens if we reduce the prominence of a certain, you know, legal procedure in society? What is the outcome of that socially? What's the outcome of that psychologically? So really understanding what happens when we begin to adjust the connections within nodes. And in a lot of ways, you know, the work that's come from I guess you look at it, artificial intelligence, you know, Ramahart's statement that the knowledge is in the connections. And I think that I would emphasize the knowledge is in the spaces, not in naming the nodes.
Okay, so you gave that talk.
Yes.
And what kind of feedback did you get?
Well, you know, there's that sometimes hard to evaluate because the people who liked it would probably come up and say, I liked it.
And the rest of the people murmur.
And there's the people who murmur, and they may just be too polite the Canadian way, right? Well, that guy just bored me for an hour. But I think generally with systems like that, they are interested in experimenting. Part of the reason, though, is that systems like Ryerson and others recognize that the students coming to their classrooms interact with technology and information differently than we have in the past. They come in with mobile devices, with social networks. They come in with an access to information that we didn't have. Not sure what your experience was like educationally, but mine consisted of time spent at a University of Manitoba library or a different library system going through stacks of journal articles. And when I found something that was relevant, a link that I liked, I had to run back and scurry through a different set of paper documents. Now these students, they hit Google Scholar and you type in what you want and you get the interconnected structure of that knowledge.
I don't mean to beat a dead horse here, but do you think there is a basic body of knowledge that all students should be equipped with by the time they leave high school?
Yes.
What might be included on that list?
Well, I think the list has grown somewhat. It's expanded, so some of the elements that we've held important in the past haven't become obsolete. So I think at a certain level, you need to, the biggest thing I would say is by the time you leave high school, you need to understand how the world works. Largely, broadly speaking, you need to understand it from a perspective of, let's say, mathematically. You need to understand it through a science lens. You need to understand it through a literature lens. You need to understand it through perhaps a sociology or sociological or similar lens. So the interest that I would have very broadly, because knowledge changes rapidly, and how we look at the world is different even today from what it was a year or 2 years ago, especially, let's say, economically. And suddenly we find all the experts were wrong. So what becomes more important isn't that did students learn to memorize all of these things, but instead can they use a lens for creative and critical thought to look at the landscape around them, bring to bear the existing knowledge they know, but most importantly, be able to question themselves. I'm always very leery of people who are very sure of the answer that they have.
Sure. What percentage of students do you think are there?
Right now?
High school grads, yeah.
Again, it would be almost impossible to give a percentage on it, but I would definitely say there is room to improve.
No kidding, room to improve. Okay, let me ask you, how much time have I got left here? Can I get like a few minutes left? Because we've got two things here that I really want to touch on. Okay, terrific. Udacity recently announced that they're in collaboration with Georgia Tech and AT&T to make available not just a course, but an entire computer science degree as a MOOC.
Yes.
That terrible acronym, Massive Open Online Course.
Right.
Is there significance in that in your view?
I think it is significant.
Because?
Well, first of all, the U.S. system is different than Canada, and we've imported the American narrative when we talk about our Canadian higher education system. We have one of the top-performing primary secondary education systems in the world. Just read today that the U.S. CEOs, for example, about 75% of them think they're very happy with their higher education system. About 24% of them are happy with their K-12 education system, whereas in our case, we have one of the top-performing K-12 systems in the world.
Yep.
So the narrative's a little different. But what's significant about Udacity is U.S. students graduate with a stunning amount of debt. Canadian students do as well, but it's not on par with
what
we see south of the border.
Yeah.
What's going to be significant here, so Udacity, there's actually a fee involved. They're going to have all of their course materials available for free, so you'll be able to take an entire master's online with Udacity, no fee. If you want recognition for that and actually get that stamp that comes from Georgia Tech, then you're going to pay about $6,000 to $7,000, which is still a fraction of a cost of what would be today to get a master's degree.
And this is a good thing?
Well, once again, we get down to good for who, because it's good for students, because they're paying less. I think it's good for society, because you're going to have more people entering the computer science field, which in many areas is now has terrific employment opportunities, but we don't have the right number of qualified candidates.
So good for the future of bricks and mortar universities?
I don't think it challenges it right now. Okay. It may down the road. I think it may be problematic for the professorate as a discipline or as a field of employment, because all of a sudden you can take your course through Udacity, and what becomes of the professor? Is your main job now to just stamp and evaluate and mark papers? Do you need a professor to do that? Can't you get a tutor to do that? So it's going to be negative, I think, for professors if this model takes off significantly.
One more thing, George. How confident are you that despite all the claims that digital technology will afford personalized education for all, that the change taking place will actually not deepen an already existing educational divide between the haves and the have-nots?
I'm very concerned about that. And there is research evidence after research evidence that emphasizes, you know, your income is in a lot of ways a primary predictor of your academic success. So if you come from a, you know, let's say the bottom quartile economically in society, chances are you will not get a degree in higher education, or you will not advance to higher education in a lot of cases. Or if you do try, you're going to fail. So there are issues there. And this is why I'm not a techno-determinist in terms of its role in education, because at this point, encouragement, social interaction, discourse with colleagues and peers is so vital to the education experience. So I think in the future we'll likely settle something that's a little more blended, at least in the near term, where we may have certain things that we'll do online to help reduce part of the cost of physical education. But those students who are most at risk of dropping out in education will likely suffer more in a purely digital education environment than they do today in a physical campus.
That is not a happy prognosis.
It's disconcerting, and educators should be reflecting on that.
Well, you've given us a lot to reflect on today, and thanks so much for coming into TVO. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
George Siemens, Athabasca University.
Support Ontario's public television. Donate at tvo.org.